Boulder might get the lion's share of the attention in this part of Colorado, but the history of Boulder County's L towns is equally interesting. On this morning's Public Affairs program, an interview with Doug Conneroe, journalist and longtime resident of Lafayette. He has written a new book called Lost Lafayette. And here's my interview with Doug Conneroe. Doug Conneroe is a fourth-generation Coloradan and is a longtime resident of Lafayette. He has a journalism degree and an MBA from CU and started writing for his family's newspaper, the Louisville Times. He's also written a new book, which is called Lost Lafayette. Thank you for joining us, Doug.
Hi, great to be here.
I wanted to start with the fact that you grew up in Louisville. I know that, Louisville
Correct.
Times. Mm-hmm. Moved to Lafayette, say, 35 years ago, it sounds like?
95, yeah.
Yeah. What inspired you to write a book about your adopted city?
The primary reason was to explore kind of unrecognized and not remembered history. There's a lot of Lafayette history and Boulder County history after the white Europeans settled here, and there is not a lot about Native peoples and not prehistory, but pre-European settlement. And there was a lot of misinformation even back then, and it's all an interpretation. History is always an interpretation, but I wanted to tell the untold stories and correct some of the misinformation as part of my community's history.
Okay, well, there are a lot of newcomers here to Colorado and Lafayette, and they might not know that very colorful history of the early Lafayette, especially its name. What people might think it has French origins. Tell us about that.
Well, Lafayette's founded by Mary Miller, and her husband was Lafayette Miller, who both of them have early ties to Boulder, settled in Boulder initially. Lafayette was a trustee in the city of Boulder and lost the mayorship by a couple of votes and loved Boulder primarily, but died at a young age of 38. And Mary Miller shortly thereafter moved to the family farm, which is now Lafayette, and founded Lafayette in 1888 and named her new community after her late husband.
All right. So no French ties, are we?
Well, it was a common name when Lafayette Miller was born. The Marquis de Lafayette had toured Missouri and really every state at the time as a farewell tour. And so it was a common name for towns and cities and children at the time. And his formal name is de Lafayette Miller. And that was just that was a part of the history of the time as a tribute to Marquis de Lafayette, who helped in the Revolutionary War.
Well, you wouldn't know it now, but mining was a huge player back in the early days of Lafayette. Tell us about mining and what else there.
Well, really, Denver is what it is today because of the coal mining that occurred in eastern Boulder County in Louisville and Lafayette, and it powered anything that was steam-powered, locomotives and energy, anything that required coal came from underground in Lafayette primarily. And the Industrial Revolution was largely due to fossil fuels and coal specifically. So all of the coal that was located in Colorado, a lot of it is in a seam that goes from roughly Marshall to Greeley, and that, at least in eastern Boulder County, was completely exploited. Almost all the coal has since been removed. And that's how Lafayette, the early economy, was coal-based. Everybody worked at the coal mines. The company doctor worked for the coal mine, and all of the coal miners were dependent. And in the winter months, particularly, is when they worked. They didn't work in the summer. But that's the root of, really, eastern Boulder County, is industrial coal mining.
And I thought it was interesting that in the early part of the 20th century, Lafayette was demographically diverse because of that. I mean, not only were there folks men coming from Europe to work the mines, there were also Latinos and Japanese living there. So it was technically more diverse then than it became later.
Sure. Initially, most of the coal miners and the management and the owners were Eastern European, were from Wales and England. And 1910, 1911 was the demarcation point in the strike that took place at the time, the coal company owners started recruiting Latinos, particularly. Rocky Mountain Fuel Company was the primary operator at the time, and they relocated their workers from Aguilar to Lafayette. So during that period of time, 1910 to 1920, there's a huge influx of Latino families, and working side by side with these Eastern European, and they're, you know, tension for sure there, but everyone worked in a dangerous environment, and they all shared that experience of being a coal miner 250 feet under the ground.
We're speaking today with Doug Conroe, who is a journalist and the author of a new book coming out called Lost Lafayette. Let me ask you, Doug, you have one chapter called A Dark Period Comes to Light. Can you share a little bit of what that's about?
That's one of the difficult parts about Lafayette history and has never been talked about, has never been reported, primarily because there was an awful influence of the Ku Klux Klan. One of the attributes of that clavern of the Ku Klux Klan was how proud they were that they had such a wide-ranging community membership and really controlled every aspect of the community. This was from 1924 to about 1935. The school board, the town board, the fire department, the Lions Club, some of the churches, and really spread their agenda of hate and intimidation and directed that hate at Latino families and at Catholics as well in the community. And because those Ku Klux Klan members were members of the founding families, Mary Miller, the town founder, her grandsons both were members of the Ku Klux Klan, and it was just not something that anybody talked about. When my family started the newspaper in Lafayette in 1974, one of the first things we did was started to explore that history as well too. And that's anything that's written was as a result of our newspaper reporting on it. And then as more digital archives became available, then I was able to flesh out most of that and get more history and associate more names to it. And that too had ties to Boulder too. The prominent Ku Klux Klan newspaper in Colorado was based in Boulder, and all of the reporting that came from Lafayette, there was a community reporter there, is in that newspaper for 6 or 8 months, and all the names are there too. And at some point somebody figured out, well, we're supposed to be anonymous, and maybe we ought to stop talking about these members who are part of our hate group. And that, fortunately, about 1936 or 1937, that faded away, the Ku Klux Klan, at least. There is a history of racism in the community. There's no question about that, even today. But organized and forceful and just a group that really, they wanted white people in town, and that was it. And it was a sad time.
Yeah, it's always very disturbing to see those photographs of Boulder, the Ku Klux Klan marching down Pearl Street in their robes in the early days. Was that a kind of a grassroots foothold that came about? It wasn't outside people that came in to Lafayette?
It was grassroots, no. And that, as I said, they were proud of how the participation of the locals in the Ku Klux Klan, they were proud of that. You know, they were looking around statewide. There was statewide influence, of course, in every community. And the governor was a part of that, sadly. But they were proud of how organized they were locally and that they had a large membership and they were active and they were visible and they controlled things.
Well, I know over in Louisville, as a result of the mining, there were tunnels running under the streets that they used during Prohibition. Is that true of Lafayette as well?
Well, in Louisville particularly, that's a little bit of a myth because both towns are undermined, both Louisville and Lafayette. Those tunnels, those passageways, are about 250 feet underground. Most of them, even the geological survey has done lots of surveys about subsidence, and most of those had collapsed, really, even in a couple of decades after the coal was mined, which would have been in the early 1900s. So, you know, what's left of them and what was left of them was pretty minimal. And it was problematic that they were so deep in the ground because you had no choice but to take an elevator. And I don't think that the rum runners would have been that smart to be able to operate an elevator and then go. It would have been too much work for that. So there, it doesn't mean that they weren't going between saloons, you know, digging in foundations and going between saloons. That certainly is possible. But no coal miner in their right mind would want to go in a coal tunnel in their off time. I mean, it was so risky and so dangerous as a vocation, and there were easier ways to get booze than risking their lives at it. So,
you know, I wrote a book of ghost stories many years ago, and one story involved the Lafayette Cemetery, mm-hmm. because there's a tombstone there carved with the name Transylvania. And there were rumors it must contain the remains of a vampire,
Vlad.
Of course.
Yeah,
Vlad. It's really a beautiful cemetery, the Lafayette Cemetery.
It
what
is.
Other landmarks should people know about in Lafayette?
You know, that's a good question, because part of the book was trying to explain things that aren't there or that are no longer there. For instance, the first transcontinental telephone call between San Francisco and New York came through Lafayette. There was a huge telecommunications backbone, telephone wires, that came through Lafayette, and there are some remnants of that. There are some of the posts, the poles that are still there. Coal mining obviously was the big vocation, and there are some tailings of the coal slack that was brought up from underground and deposited in a big pile, and there are a couple of those, but no mine structures. We do have, when the coal companies, during the strike in 1910, they decided they were going to build their own structures so they could keep the strike breakers, the scabs, close to the mine and away from the conflict. And so those structures have been distributed in the community. People move them and currently live in them, but those are almost unrecognizable as well. So there, you really, if you scratch the surface, you can find these things. They're not noticeable. They're not obvious. And they, in some respects, they were happy to get rid of them. So it had to have a railroad infrastructure. There was because they had to haul the coal to Denver via rail cars, and Louisville, it's more obvious. The railroad still goes through Louisville, but they're now walking trails, but those are old railroad beds are in and around Lafayette, and you see a little bit of that, but that too is faded, that transport by rail. So yeah, they're Vlad is still at the cemetery, though. That's the vampire. And And aside to that is that the city doesn't like at all that the cemetery is for reverence and reflection and remembrance, and it's not for entertainment. And so they get really irritated when Vlad is talked about, because it's interesting, and I'm glad it's a part of Lafayette history. And no one would have a reason to go to a cemetery, a historic cemetery particularly, otherwise. So I'm glad that people are visiting and recognizing some of the other tombstones and some of the other names. I think that's important.
Well, and it comes up like every 10 years, some new group of ghost hunters discovers the tombstone in Lafayette.
Right.
It's much like the ghost at the Hotel Boldorado or something like that. It just catches fire for a little bit and then dies down and then comes back
it
up
does.
Again.
Yeah. It does. Yeah.
Well, I've read that you've been a member of the Lafayette Historical Society for many years, and so you've had access to old documents about the town. I wondered if you've turned up anything, in addition to the extensive research you did on the KKK there in Lafayette, research that you didn't know, something that surprised you, that as a result of looking through documents you went, wow, didn't know that.
Yeah, sure. One of the biggest surprises was Mary Miller was known for her temperance being part of the temperance movement and prohibition, particularly avid anti-alcohol, founded the town with what was called the liquor clause, where you were allowed to possess alcohol, but you couldn't give it away or sell it. So constructed around that narrative was the fact that a lot of it had to do with her husband's death, with Lafayette's death, and in the death notices was attributed to Bright's disease, and they had a couple of other sort of early medical terms, but it was cirrhosis of the liver is what Lafayette died from. And so researching these historical documents, he and his brother, this is Mary Miller's, he and his brother-in-law, so Mary Miller's brother, had a liquor distributorship in Boulder while they were here. And then you go back even earlier than that, find out that when Mary and Lafayette ran a stage stop near Lafayette, and this was 1863, 1864, they'd actually applied with the county commissioners for a liquor license. And that was a huge surprise. So here is an event in Mary Miller's life that was so losing her husband, figuring out a way to memorialize him and naming the town after him. And the whole backstory is that there was a terrible influence of alcohol in his life, particularly. You can see that, and Mary Miller's brother, Lafayette's brother-in-law, and that's not an obvious sort of thing. You see that reflected when she banned alcohol for sale and prohibited saloons was primarily what that was. But that's really, everyone thought she had a lifelong feeling for prohibition and anti-alcohol and whatever. And maybe, but I think it was primarily due to her husband having problems, and she decided that was a way to solve it, was to keep saloons out of Lafayette. So,
well, this was obviously a labor of love for a community that you love. So what was your process for writing it? How long did it take? You know, how did it come about that you have now published this?
Well, this is a sequel and really an update to a book that I wrote in 2016 and 2017. And I had spent about 3 or 4 years researching and writing that book. And then this is an updated version of it, which has new chapters on the KKK particularly, but then water law and irrigation. So it's been a long time. It's been an assemblage of some of the work that my mother had done. She wrote 3 history books on the history of Louisville, which had Lafayette content in it as well. And my dad wrote a history book about the eastern plains of Colorado and homesteading and that aspect of it, which is a part of my book as well, too. So there's a little bit of a genetic link there as well, too. And I hope my work is scrutinized, just as I've scrutinized the contribution of other historians, and I'm not degrading them at all in their work. But there are some inaccuracies that I've corrected in my writings, and I hope somebody scrutinizes my work. And in 10 years or 2 years or 200 years, they find new information and revise what I've written if need be. So.
And we're speaking with Doug Conero. He's a Lafayette resident and the author of a new book called Lost Lafayette. Well, speaking of your parents, Doug, I can't let this go because I was a Cub reporter when I met your dad, Percy, who was quite a character.
Yes.
And wrote some heavy-duty editorials for the Lafayette paper, the Louisville Times. I particularly remember reading that. And I think perhaps in private, his bark was a little bit louder than his bite. But when he wrote an editorial, boy, you stood up, you paid attention.
And I learned and was taught to express how I felt. And I learned at an early age that there was a cost to that. He was not popular in some neighborhoods.
He was very conservative.
He was very conservative. And he always tried to hold those in power accountable. That was his primary. That was what drove him to be a journalist and be an opinionated journalist. And he researched everything that he did, and I learned from that as part of it. He taught me to think about things before I talk and before I write, to make sure that what I do write is accurate and defendable. And then my mother was that same way too, that, you know, making sure you research things and making sure you, if somebody asks you to, where did you get that, then you can tell them. And I think he made Louisville and Lafayette particularly what they are today. He helped set that foundation for those communities and the way they've grown and the way they've prospered and the amenities that they've built, and they are great places to live because of his efforts. So,
well, I suppose it's kind of like Maureen Dowd with the New York Times or something. I remember opening up the Louisville Times just quickly to turn to that page to see what Percy had written this week. Yes,
absolutely. Part of that was that even the opinions that I have today was, and you as a journalist, if you say something that's wrong or you report something that's wrong, you hear about that in a nanosecond. I mean, somebody's on you. They're calling or emailing or texting, or they're like, oh, you got that wrong. And it was never the case with him, that he wrote things that were correct and accurate, and you never heard back from the criticisms if they were directed at individuals, because they were true and correct. And I find that today as well, too, that the longer it takes somebody to respond to an opinion that you have, the more accurate and correct you are about it. I guess that's the only other way to put that, is that you, if you have an opinion, make sure you've researched it and you can defend it.
Talking there about Percy Conroe, Doug's father. He passed away in what year, Doug?
2013. So it's been, 8 years.
So you kind of got the journalism bug, but also the history bug from both of your parents. And so this is what you do.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a hobby. I have a journalism background, obviously, and I'm currently a general contractor, so I help refurbish old houses and have done that as a hobby as well, too. But anyone who's an historian and writes local history knows that it's a labor of love, and there's no money in it, and I'll never make back all the hundreds of hours invested in primary research. I mean, it's digging through boxes of files at the Denver Public Library. That was all part of it. And it's something that I feel like I needed to give back to the community, and something that someone can appreciate in 100 years.
Thank you, Doug. Anything else you wanted to add that you wanted to talk about that our listeners might be interested in?
The book has a beginning chapter and an end chapter for a reason. The beginning chapter, it talks a lot about Native peoples, the Cherokee Trail, the Arapahoes, who were a part of Eastern Boulder County, all of Boulder County particularly, and the early stagecoach that was a part of that, and the conflict related to that slow, steady drip of white settlement that was early on. And the last chapter talks about the Borrego family and the history of the Borrego family. They farmed in Lafayette, but the ancestors of the Borregos were some of the first farmers in the San Luis Valley as part of the Mexico land grants. Established the acequias, the irrigation systems that are there, which is the foundation of modern water law and modern irrigation. And that's overlooked in Colorado history, particularly that this farming agricultural base of industry, which is important and has been important, is based largely on the water laws that were established, water policy that was established in the San Luis Valley. And a family in Lafayette was an important part of that. And I think that was a good way to wrap up the book, was to talk about the Borrego family's contribution.
And I assume that we're going to be able to soon find your book at...
You can find a link through LafayetteHistory.com, which is my history blog. And it's Arcadia Publishing is the publisher of it. They publish a lot of local history books. And in Lafayette, will be available at Jack's Outdoor, and then at Walgreens. My previous book, it's difficult to find retailers, and I have historically sold a few books online and through the Lafayette Historical Society and through some local retailers. Hopefully we have a broad distribution. That's the important part of it. I'm happy either way. If I sell one book and people read it and I make an impact, that's a great thing. And if I sell 200,000, that's a great thing too. But it's a historical document, and it's my interpretation of history, and I hope that people appreciate it.
Well, good luck with that. The author of Lost Lafayette, Doug Conroe. And thank you for listening to our public affairs program this morning.